even got switched to Tacoma. When he got switched to Tacoma, he got off the bus the first time and they put him right back on. He ended up going back to Oregon again because they just said your court date's revoked. So he had to come back again. He came back for his court date on April 6th, and he finally got deported 2 days ago, and he was treated really bad in the Tacoma facility.
You have how many children together? Are they American citizens?
Yes.
How old are they?
I have a 7-year-old, I have a 2-year-old, and an 8-month-old.
Matamoros Villalpando, can you talk about the fact that this is a for-profit prison and what difference you think this makes? They're being sued under slavery, anti-slavery laws in Aurora, in a jail there. What about in Tacoma?
Yeah, we know this is one of the largest detention centers in the West Coast and the nation. They make a lot of money out of engaging our families in there, $165, I believe, per day per person. And the jobs that people are getting paid to do inside for $1 a day is not everything that they do inside. We have reports that people are asked to paint the walls or wax the floors in exchange for having a piece of chicken or a piece of candy. And sometimes not even that. They're just promised that and that doesn't happen. We also have seen a lot of reports that the food is always bad, but sometimes it's not only that, it's the fact that the portions are getting smaller. And when people complain about that, GEO guards say, well, there's just too many of you. What do you want us to do?
We have to leave it there, but we're going to continue the conversation after the show and post it at democracynow.org. We're speaking with Matamoros Villalpando with Northwest Detention Center Resistance and the group Mi Gente, and Alexis Erickson, whose partner is hunger striker Christian Lopez. As a result, he was sent to a New Mexico jail from Tacoma. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, and the time is 5:01. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the screening of Food Chains, The Revolution in America's Fields, taking place Friday, April 14th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Food Chains is a documentary film about the group of Florida farm workers and their Fair Food Program, who partner with growers and retailers to improve working conditions for farm laborers in the United States. Screening will be followed by a panel discussion with Licia Anderson of the Western Farm Workers Association and Ramon Ramirez of PECUN. Again, the screening of Food Chains, The Revolution in America's Fields is taking place Friday, April 14th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1121 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland has joined Seattle in the fight against Trump's threat to sanctuary cities.
Portland dreamer Emmanuel Frutos was released from federal custody yesterday after spending 18 days in an ICE detention center.
KBOO's Teresa Mitchell interviewed Truthout's Gareth about the Syrian gas attacks.
Yeah. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 14th, the 94th day of the Trumpocalypse. I'm Ruben Lawrence.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund. On Wednesday, the Portland City Council voted to join Seattle in its suit on the federal government over the Trump administration's threat to sanctuary cities. The vote, which was prompted by Mayor Wheeler, was carried by a vote of 3-0. Commissioners Fritz and Salzman were absent and did not vote. The suit resulted from a March press conference in which Attorney General Jeff Sessions threatened to use whatever legal tools were available to reclaim any federal funds that were provided to sanctuary cities. 2 days after the speech, the city of Seattle filed the suit citing the 10th Amendment, which prohibits the federal government from forcing state and local governments to do its job. The suit also claims that the threat violates the Constitution's spending clause, which is intended to prevent the federal government from coercing state or local action through the denial of funds. Nearly $30 million in federal grants to Portland are at risk in the administration if the administration blocks payments to sanctuary cities. Seattle's city attorney is said to have welcomed Portland's participation in the suit, and Mayor Wheeler stated that, quote, "By partnering with Seattle, we send a unified message as the Northwest," end quote.
The small town of Port Orford on Oregon's southern coast is getting ready to join the nationwide tax march protest on April 15th. KBOO reporter Tom Flynn has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
Oregonians are joining protesters across the nation on Saturday in the tax march, calling on President Trump to reveal his tax returns. The marches and rallies will also highlight Trump's proposed budget, an outline of how Americans' tax dollars could be spent in 2018. Among the cities protesting is Port Orford, a small outpost on Oregon's southern coast. The unassuming town, with a population of a little more than 1,000, has been embroiled in national politics since the 2016 election. But Pollyanne Balch-Rancourt with Action Port Orford says people in town have been active in local politics for a long time now, and she thinks she knows why.
Standing for our principles. It's not enough to just complain to our friends and like-minded people. It's important to represent our principles in action.
Trump is the first president to refuse to release his tax returns to the public in 40 years. He says he doesn't release his returns while they're being audited. While the biggest march is expected to be in Washington, D.C., local marches are scheduled to take place across Oregon, including in Bend, Eugene, Grants Pass, and Coos Bay. In January, the Women's March in Port Orford drew around 300 people from the town and surrounding area. Since the election, protesters on the southern coast have been working with Indivisible, the dispersed activist network organizing against the Trump administration in cities across the country, which also has been involved in organizing tax marches. Balch-Rancourt says the message of the march is simple. Trump deserves to be held accountable for his taxes.
We believe that you should show your taxes to the American people because you work for us now. You're not just a private businessman. And then secondarily, Congress, why aren't you doing something about this?
The Tax March website also says the president should, quote, commit to a fair tax system for the American people, end quote, and that it's important for the Americans to know if Trump is hiding any conflicts of interest in his taxes. The march is taking place on April 15th, typically the day taxes are due. This year, the deadline for taxes is Tuesday, April 18th. For KBOO News, in cooperation with Oregon News Service, this is reporter Tom Flynn.
Portland dreamer Emmanuel Frutos was released from federal custody yesterday after spending 18 days in an ICE detention center. The 21-year-old, who has lived in the United States since the age of 6, was picked up at his home by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents who misled him about the reason for their visit. According to Frutos, the agent told him that he needed to accompany them to sign some paperwork regarding his case. He was subsequently arrested and placed in the detention center in Tacoma, Washington. Frutos, who is being treated for a bipolar disorder, has physical limitations that require the use of a wheelchair, yet despite these limitations, he was classified as a flight risk by ICE officials. He was denied the use of a wheelchair during the first 3 days he was in custody and was only provided with one after receiving a doctor's note. He gained his release by posting $10,000 bail after repeated calls from supporters and congressional representatives on his behalf. During a press conference earlier today, Frutos thanked the many supporters who called on him or wrote letters to ICE on his behalf.
A proposal by the U.S. Forestry Service to allow logging on Mount Hood has encountered strong resistance from local environmentalists. The service wants to allow logging in a 13,000-acre area, roughly the size of Manhattan. The plan would allow for thinning of a mature area of growth that the Forest Service claims is at risk of fire due to a thick growth of underbrush and small trees. But critics maintain that it's a mature area that is, quote, economically sound and stable, and that it does not need to be logged at all, end quote. The project is currently under review and will be open to public comment in the weeks and months ahead.
Oregon's only Republican congressman is Greg Walden, who represents most of Oregon east of the Cascades. Walden has caught flack recently for not holding a town hall in Bend, the largest and bluest city in the district. So yesterday, Walden appeared in a Bend gymnasium in front of a crowd of over 3,000 people. It was a raucous event with the audience weighted against Walden, but well peppered with supporters as well. Here he answers a question about climate change.
So the question is about climate change and the environment. So the good news is, because of the development of natural gas in America, we've been able to ratchet down our CO2 emissions to 2 miles per gallon. As a result, we're using less coal power. And as a result, we've improved infrastructure in distribution lines, power lines, if you will, and investments that are coming. We now are better able to link renewable energy throughout our region. Pacific Corp just announced a multi-billion-dollar expansion of the power grid in Wyoming and Utah that will now connect in. The climate clearly is changing and it's getting warmer. All right, so I don't know. The question is what we do about it. The question is how we deal with this as a country. And so there are smart things we can do that will continue to bring down our emissions. More renewables, a more effective energy grid, distributed energy, battery technology, battery-operated vehicles to reduce our fleet, solar, hydro. We just are working on in-stream hydro, advances in hydro. We just had hearings on them. Geothermal. We have legislation on all those issues coming.
That was a soundbite from Greg Walden's town hall in Bend yesterday. Walden got a similar, if not even angrier, reception at two town halls, one in the Dalles and one in Hood River, earlier this week. The main issue stuck in his constituents' collective craw is Walden's role in the failed attempt by the House to repeal and replace Obamacare last month. Walden aligned himself firmly with the Speaker Paul Ryan and his attempt to cut Medicare and other parts of the federal health care system. More than a third of Walden's constituents are covered by Medicare.
Private prison operators are already cashing in on the Trump immigration crackdown. The GEO Group announced Thursday it has secured a contract with the government to build a new 1,000-bed, $110 million immigration prison in Conroe, Texas, just north of Houston. The contract comes as the GEO Group faces a class action lawsuit in Colorado, where at least 60,000 immigrants accuse the for-profit detention company of forcing them to work for little or no pay under threat of solitary confinement. Hannah Lay Myers reports.
I'm outside the ICE Detention Center in Aurora, Colorado, also called the Denver Contract Detention Facility. The front of the building is painted a bright blue. It looks very new, not at all like a lot of the older government-run facilities. one would assume such a large, kempt-looking institution would employ a large staff to keep it so well-maintained. But as it turns out, the detainees themselves may be a non-consenting work crew forced to keep this place spick and span. In March, a federal judge approved class action status for a lawsuit alleging at least 60,000 past and present detainees held at the Aurora ICE facility were forced to do janitorial work, clerical work, landscaping, and other jobs for free or a dollar a day. Those who refuse are threatened with solitary confinement, a threat immigrants like this former anonymous detainee say carries a lot of weight.
It was like hell on earth. If you're not strong enough, you will want to die in there.
It's the first class action lawsuit in U.S. history obligating a private prison to fight claims of forced labor in court. The Aurora facility is one of more than 140 detention centers operated by GEO Group, the second largest private prison operator, incarcerating more immigrants than any other company worldwide. In a statement, GEO Group says they strongly refute the forced labor allegations and intend to continue to vigorously defend the company against the claims. Since the case was filed in 2014, GEO Group has insisted their so-called volunteer work program policies are set by the federal government, but judges aren't convinced. Nina DeSalvo, executive director of Towards Justice and one of the attorneys behind the lawsuit, says the case's new class action status gives a frightened and marginalized community the power to fight such a powerful organization.
These are practices that GEO has engaged in for a very long time, but they have yet to be challenged in the courts, which I think speaks mostly to the difficulties that vulnerable populations have accessing the courts in the absence of the class action mechanism.
Since President Trump took office, GEO stock has risen 98%. Just weeks after Attorney General Jeff Sessions was sworn in, he reversed plans to phase out federal use of private prisons. And this week, during a border visit in Arizona, Sessions announced plans to hire 125 more immigration judges as part of the administration's commitment to increased immigration enforcement.
For those that continue to seek improper and illegal entry into this country, be forewarned. This is a new era. This is the Trump era.
Considering the Trump administration's plan is to ramp up detentions, locations like this one are only expected to get bigger and busier. This facility can hold as many as 900 immigrants a day, and the plan is to increase capacity here to hold as many as 1,400 detainees at a time. DeSalvo says the planned increase in immigrant detentions is all the more reason why the lawsuit is more important than ever.
The new administration at the federal level is interested in more aggressively deporting undocumented immigrants in this country. That will require more and more people to be detained, which I think just adds urgency to our case.
For years, the public has regularly protested outside the Aurora ICE facility and many others nationwide, decrying the unjust treatment of immigrants jailed within. This week, more than 750 immigrants held in another GEO Group detention center, this one in Washington State, went on hunger strike. Some also called for a work stoppage. Like the Aurora facility, detainees at the Northwest Detention Center are also forced to work for a dollar a day. For the plaintiffs in the Aurora forced labor lawsuit, the class action certification is clearly a legal leap forward. But the case is likely to drag through the courts for years. Yet immigrants and their advocates are hopeful that protests and legal actions will prove to be powerful weapons in the fight against the Trump administration's policies that are leaning increasingly towards mass deportations. Hanley Myers, FSRN, Denver.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communications. The report focuses on how climate change is impacting listeners' lives. In today's report, we focus on a California organization that's preserving unusual varieties of fruits and vegetables that might flourish in warmer climates.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When Rowan White was 17, she started working on an organic farm, and she discovered that there was more to the world of fruits and vegetables than what's for sale in most supermarkets.
We were seeding in the greenhouse 50 different types of heirloom tomatoes.
Now, two decades later, White directs Sierra Seeds. It's an organization in Northern California that sells local seeds and teaches people how to save seeds from their own plants. White says preserving local varieties of fruits and vegetables can help us prepare for the changes brought by global warming. It's hard to know which varieties of a plant will survive a new pest or new growing conditions, so the more varieties that are grown, the more likely it is that some will prevail.
Diversity is at the foundation of resilience.
In the past, crop diversity was common, but now, as many farmers only grow one or two crops, this genetic diversity is threatened. In fact, about three-quarters of the world's fruit and vegetable varieties have gone extinct in the last century because people stopped growing them. But White says a seed is like a little bit of hope, and there's still time to cultivate our own. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for a partly cloudy day with temperatures in the low 60s. East of the Cascades and Hood River, you can expect a mostly sunny day with a high of about 63. On this date in 1865, President Abraham Lincoln was shot by John Wilkes Booth while attending a play at the Ford Theater in Washington. The 56-year-old president died the next day. The quote of the day is from Lincoln, who said, quote, "Nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power," end quote.
Many media talking heads and politicians viewed last week's missile attack on a Syrian airbase as a defining moment for the man who is growing into his job as President of the United States. In this week's Alternative Facts commentary, KBOO's Ray Bodwell shares a different opinion.
Alternative Facts.
As a result of the United States missile attack on a Syrian airbase, it appears that the budding bromance between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin is over. Last week, in response to graphic images and the tearful pleadings of his daughter Ivanka, Trump hurled 59 cruise missiles at the Syrian airbase that carried out the chemical attack against the rebel-held town of Khan Sheikhoun. The attack resulted in the deaths of at least 89 people, including numerous children.
Assad choked out the lives of helpless men, women, and children. Tonight I ordered a military strike on the airfield from where the chemical attack was launched.
Immediately following the U.S. attack, the Russian president accused the United States of, quote, "an act of aggression against the sovereign state and a violation of international law," end quote. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson responded by condemning the alliance between Russia and Syria.
And I think further, it is very important that the Russian government consider carefully their continued support for the Assad regime.
After the attacks, media pundits once again cried out that Trump was finally rising to the occasion. Here's Fareed Zakaria of CNN.
I think Donald Trump became president of the United States. I think this was actually a big moment.
But did he really? Or was this just another in a long line of Trump misdirection plays? Despite his seemingly heartfelt distress over the horrible deaths suffered by the victims of the attack, Trump has a long history of tweeting against U.S. involvement in Syria. In August of 2013, he tweeted, quote, "Remember, all these freedom fighters in Syria just want to fly planes into our buildings." And later that month, he tweeted, quote, "What will we get for bombing Syria besides more debt and a possible long-term conflict? Obama needs congressional approval, end quote. As a sidebar, it's worth noting that Trump himself did not get congressional approval for his attack. And he certainly doesn't care about Syrian refugees as human beings. In November of 2015, he tweeted, quote, "Refugees from Syria are now pouring into our great country. Who knows who they are? Some could be ISIS. Is our president insane?" And during the campaign, he said this about all Syrian refugees.
"I'm putting the people on notice that are coming here from Syria as part of this mass migration, that if I win, they're going back."
But perhaps the most telling of all Trump tweets is this one from October of 2012, where he said, quote, "Now that Obama's poll numbers are in a tailspin, watch for him to launch a strike in Libya or Iran. He is desperate." In October of 2012, Obama's Gallup approval ratings ranged between 50 and 52%. Over the last 30 days, Trump's approval ratings have ranged from 36 to 40%. So was that 2012 tweet simply a foreshadowing of Trump's game plan once he decided that his situation was desperate? Or was the missile attack on Syria another brilliant Trump head fake to take America's eye off the ball? We now know that the Russians were warned in advance, and they in turn warned the Syrians. This overwhelming attack on the Syrian airbase didn't even damage the runways. Portland streets are probably in worse condition than those runways. But in the weeks since the Syrian attack, and yesterday's dropping of the mother of all bombs in Afghanistan, here's just a slice of the continuing domestic damage the Trump administration has inflicted on America. Attorney General Jeff Sessions referred to immigrants illegally crossing the border as, quote, filth, and ratcheted up an already aggressive anti-immigrant campaign by creating a deportation task force. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos rolled back two Obama-era protections for student loan borrowers. On Wednesday, Trump threatened to shut off $7 billion in Obamacare cost-sharing subsidies for low-income health insurance customers if the Democrats refused to go along with his plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. And on Thursday, he signed legislation that cuts off federal funding to Planned Parenthood and any other agency that performs abortions. Donald Trump and his Republican administration doesn't care any more about those Syrian babies than he does for the former coal miner with black lung disease who won't be able to afford his health insurance, or the college graduate with enormous school loans that will weigh her down for the rest of her life. Donald Trump only cares about his overinflated sense of self, and the surest way to reinforce that is to continue to curry favor with the richest and most powerful corporations and individuals in America. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Tensions continue to rise between the U.S. and North Korea as the USS Carl Vinson Strike Force stood off the Korean coast. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi was quoted in the New York Times today as saying, quote, "The United States and South Korea and North Korea are engaging in tit-for-tat, with swords drawn and bows bent, and there have been storm clouds gathering. If war breaks out on the Korean Peninsula, multiple parties will lose and no one will win," end quote. According to the BBC, Wang also said, quote, "One has the feeling that a conflict could break out at any moment. We call on all parties to refrain from provoking and threatening each other, whether in words or actions, and not let the situation get to an irreversible and unmanageable stage," end quote. Missiles, military displays, and parades are an expected part of this Saturday's Day of the Sun holiday in the capital, Pyongyang, which celebrates the late North Korean leader Kim Il-sung's 105th birthday. The Trump administration has warned that it may contemplate a military strike if the North Korean government presses ahead with suspected plans to set off another underground nuclear device. There has also been speculation that the U.S. warships nearby may shoot down North Korean missile tests. An expert quoted by the Washington Post said that, though the situation was tense, there was little risk of a nuclear war. Residents of Seoul are reported to be proceeding with business as usual. But Air China announced a suspension of service to Pyongyang, and commercial air charts showed a complete stoppage of service to the airport.
Last week, the United States launched a missile attack against a Syrian airbase in response to an alleged sarin gas attack by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Since then, the Syrian president has claimed that reports on the gas attack were a complete fabrication, but eyewitness reports from medical staff and survivors insist the attack happened. Earlier today, KABU's Teresa Mitchell had the opportunity to interview Truthout's journalist Gareth Porter to get his thoughts on the attack.
You have an article in Truthout, and I understand from reading that that sarin gas may have been released from the ground rather than dropped from the air.
Well, you know, first of all, I should say that I'm not convinced that we know that it's sarin gas at all. And that the reason, very briefly, for that statement is that my research on the other incidents beginning in 2013 in Syria suggests that it's more likely that what has been released in some of these incidents was not sarin gas, but a smoke munition that both the Syrian government and the rebels have had in their arsenals, which turns into phosphine gas in contact with moist air and causes symptoms which mimic those of sarin gas exposure. So I think that it's more likely, in fact, that it was not sarin gas, but this other toxic substance that has been used clearly by the rebels or has been at least in the arsenals of both the rebels and the Syrian government. But yes, there was a some sort of toxic gas released without any questions that killed dozens of people in Syria, in this town in Syria. And according to Ted Postol, who is a wonderful expert on missiles and rockets, this what was found in that crater in the road, cited by the U.S. government or U.S. Officials as the source of the toxic gas attack, was not released from the air. It was a, he calls it an improvised device, which he believes could not have been fired from the air, but would have had to have been launched on the ground, because he sees evidence that there was an explosive put on top of it that forced it into the ground